With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Shall I tell you the story about Gove's penis?
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, acting editor of CapEx. Our guest this week is the journalist and author Owen Bennett. Owen has been a member of the parliamentary lobby since 2014, writing for publications such as the Daily Express, Huffington Post and City AM. He was recently appointed Whitehall editor at the Daily Telegraph. In between reporting on the highs and lows of British politics, he's managed to write three books: Following Farage, The Brexit Club and his soon-to-be-released biography of Michael Gove, A Man in a Hurry. We sat down to talk about Gove's upbringing, his time in the Oxford Union and those infamous cocaine revelations.
Well, Owen, thanks very much for joining us on Free Exchange. Your book about Michael Gove is out. Which date exactly, just for our listeners?
It's out the 25th. It should be in all good bookshops then.
Okay, that's this Friday.
Thursday.
Off to a flyer there. has the subject of the book given you his thoughts on your work at all?
Well, there was an interesting moment. So when the leadership contest was going on, all the leadership contenders came through and gave a sort of 20-minute question and answer session to the press gallery, to the lobby, one at a time. And then when Gove came in, I asked a question, and the Christopher Hope from the Telegraph, who was chairing it, said, "Brace yourself, everyone, Owen Bennett with a question." And before I could get the question out, Michael Gove said, "Owen, I want to say congratulations." And I said, "Michael, I couldn't have done it without you." And he laughed. It just kind of dispelled all a little bit, a little bit of tension that there was between us. But he's been absolutely fine. He is he's an old hack, as I detail in the book. He worked in journalism for, you know, number sort of 20, 30 years. He wrote a book himself about a politician, about Michael Portillo. So he is used to this kind of game. So I think he understands that it's not personal. It's just, you know, the way that these things have to happen.
I think the Portillo one's quite a salutary lesson about writing political biographies.
Well, it's funny, I learned two things from Gove's book on Portillo. Number one is, don't call your book Future of the Right, because Portillo then, 2 years later, lost his seat in Parliament, famously. And the other thing, actually, was that Gove's book about Portillo, the big thing about Portillo was in 1999, but Gove's book came out in 95. In 1999, Portillo admitted that he'd had homosexual relationships while at university, and this was seen as a big thing for the Tory party to have a leading politician admit this. And also because Portillo's voting record on equal rights wasn't that strong, so it was seen as a degree of hypocrisy. And lots of questions were asked of Gove: did you know about this, Michael? We'll not put it in the book because you're such a big fan of Portillo. If you didn't know about it, did you not carry enough research? So I was very clear that if I missed a story or found a story I didn't put in the book, like the cocaine story, then I would be accused of making exactly the same mistakes that Gove made about Portillo. So I was trying to learn from Gove there. I'm sure he doesn't really appreciate that irony, but that's what I was trying to do.
I mean, did you want it to be, would you have preferred it to be an authorised biography and him to do lots of interviews with you? I mean, what was the process there in terms of putting it to him that you were doing this book?
I think it was fine the way it was. I think even if it had been authorised, some people may not have still wanted to talk to me. There was people who didn't want to talk to me. Nick Bowles, for example, didn't want to talk to me, which was quite frustrating because he'd been friends with Nick Bowles for a number of years. And Nick was one of the people, actually, who played a big role in moving Michael away from this Thatcherite, tub-thumping guy in the late 90s. So actually someone who really got the agenda around modernisation a lot more. That was a big influence of Nick Bowles. It's a shame I didn't get to hear from Nick directly for that. But, you know, both views present this challenge. If I'd done an authorised biography, maybe I wouldn't have been able to put the cocaine story in. Maybe he would have come to deal with not, and yeah, I might have had better access to some aspects of his life, but it would have been seen as a bit of a mouthpiece for him. So I was quite happy being slightly outside of it all.
How did you feel in terms of the timing? It's slightly... Do you think it was unfortunate that it happened to coincide with the Tory leadership in the way it did? Or is it just one of them things, as they say?
Well, you know, the book's coming out Thursday, 25th of July. We got the Civilization out in the mail in the beginning of June. So that was our decision. So I can't sort of sit here and say, oh, isn't it terrible? Because, you know, we decided that the moment of maximum impact for the book was then. And I think we were approved right. You know, there is some people who say, well, this book has, you know, it killed Gove's leadership chances. And actually, what you've done is you've kind of, you know, you've killed your own project. And I kind of disagree with that. I don't think Gove would have become Prime Minister anyway. I think Boris would always have won. I'm not even sure if we'd have got down to the final two. And I think Gove is always going to play an important role in political life. You know, he was sacked from the cabinet effectively in 2014 and made chief whip. He came back. He was sacked by May after the leadership contest 2016. He came back. So the chances of him, you know, he is a guy who's got great, as Alex Ferguson would say, bounce back ability. So that is what Gove is specialises at. So the idea that this book is now completely useless, he says, to any listeners out there considering buying it, I'd say still buy it because Gove is going to play a key role in particularly in Brexit.
I mean, do you see him at any point doing a Cameron or an Osborne and just withdrawing from frontline politics? Or do you think he's there for the long haul in a way that they perhaps weren't?
I think that the motivations of those three are very different. And I think that Cameron and Osborne, as Cameron famously said, why do you want to be Prime Minister? Because I think I'll be good at it. If you ask Gove why he wants to be Prime Minister, he will reel off a list of things he wants to change about the country based on personal experience, based on reading experts, which you know, he famously derided, but actually he places great stock in expertise. So I think Gove is much more focused by aims and goals and solid achievements, whereas Cameron and Osborne were much more focused on a sense of perhaps, I don't know, public service is the right way of putting it. So if Gove was to be tempted away from politics, I think it would have to be for such a job that would enable him to still feel like he was having an impact.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I mean, what do you see his immediate future? We are recording this the day before the new Prime Minister is announced. I mean, do you think Gove will continue to be a key member of the sort of Team Johnson despite all the past, everything that's gone on between them?
It's really tricky, isn't it? I think if Johnson was to win with a huge landslide, right? I think
assuming Johnson wins,
if he was swing by a huge landslide, 80-20, right? He might feel, actually, I don't need to keep in people in my tent. I don't, you know, that have annoyed me. People like Gove. I've got such a mandate for my membership. If it's slightly tight, if it's 60-40, 65-35, he might think, no, there's got to be unity in the party. And I also think that with the arithmetic so tight as it is in the Commons, putting Gove on the back benches, there's another guy that's, you know, he's not bound by collective responsibility and Gove will do his own thing. So pragmatically, I think it makes sense to keep Gove in cabinet. The question is then, what do you do? Do you keep him at DEFRA, which I think Gove would probably still relish? I think it is one of the big departments that's going to benefit from Brexit in terms of things you can do. Or do you, I think one thing you could do if you were being Machiavellian and you're Boris Johnson, you could say, right, what do we need to do in this country to get people back voting for us? We need to build more houses. Who better to send out and tell all the Tories we've got to build in their lovely Greenbelt land than Michael Gove? So you say, go on, Michael, you take this sticky wicket and you go out and you bat on it.
It's interesting you say that, because I think, looking at me now, he seems quite a different politician to the conflict for conflict's sake figure we had, especially at the Department for Education. I mean, you talked about him being a tub-thumping figure in the late 90s. I think character-wise, there still seems to be some of that in him. But do you think he's changed and morphed a bit and adapted himself to the preoccupations of our age, you know, things like plastics, animal rights and stuff like this?
Yes, I think with education, he'd had 3 years as Shadow Education Secretary before he got into government. So I think he'd had 3 years of, like, building himself up, waiting for the starter pistol to go. So he got in, you know, pushes through the Academies Act in 50 days or something, 60 days. You know, the most transformative piece of legislation for education probably since the 60s. Then he has people around him like Dominic Cummings, who are very combative. He fed off that style a little bit. But then when he gets to justice and environment, he has to take a slower view on these things. He's not given as much thought. And in the book, you know, there's quotes from people like Friends of the Earth, who get phone calls from Gove, and they spend, you know, not just 5 minutes, like 15, 20 minutes just saying, well, tell me what you think we should do with the environment. You know, they're really surprised, like, wow, I did not expect that from Gove. So Gove, I think, has changed as a politician. He's gone from someone who, it used to be, particularly education, it wasn't enough to win. He had to beat people, and they had to know why they were beating and agree with him and agree that he was right. I think he's slightly different now.
And what do you think, I mean, coming back to why he's in politics in the first place, what do you think motivates him? Is there a moment in his life, having looked through it all, where you think that's the one that gets him into politics and turns him into this sort of person?
I think there's a few moments, right? The key one is obviously his adoption. You know, he was born to a single mother. He was actually born in Aberdeen. She was in Edinburgh, and he was then taken back to Edinburgh and put into care. And he was adopted by this family, this fishing family, working-class fishing family, working-class, lower middle class. No one had, you know, stayed at school from the age of 15. No one had left Aberdeen. The family tree is all labourers and people who worked in fishing and sort of menial jobs. They saw they had a really smart kid and invested in him and put him to private school. And he benefited from that. He realised he could have ended up with the family. It didn't do that. He got to buy a family that didn't do that, that made him work in the, you know, in the fishing industry in Aberdeen. So I think he's very, very aware that his life could be very different, and he's aware that he was lucky to get that chance. And therefore, he wants everyone to get that chance. He wants everyone to have a route to being Lord Justice Secretary, right? To being a leader writer for the Times, being the cabinet minister. That's the route that he wants to give everyone. So that is a very important motivation. The other thing is his father selling the family business in about 1983, 1984, because of the fear of the common fisheries policy. He has an emotional reaction to the European Union, which Boris Johnson doesn't have. A lot of these Brexiteers don't have. He has a real emotional reaction to it. So when people say he's not a real Brexiteer, you know, people like Marc Francois, it baffles me, because he's more of a real Brexiteer than a lot of these people. He has an emotional reaction to the point that actually, I think it slightly clouds his judgment on the issue. Mm. Perhaps in a way that doesn't. So I think those two things are key. And then the other moment is actually when he sees the Tories lose in 2001. You know, he had, not did they lose, they didn't even, I think they gained one seat or net zero, I think. Yeah. it was even less than that compared to the Labour landslide. At that point, he suddenly thought, I need to get involved a bit more here, because the Tories were just going down the same route again and they weren't modernising. I think that was a key moment as well.
Okay. I mean, and when you were doing your... I mean, what was your process in terms of compiling stuff for the book? Obviously, when you're writing about someone about whom so much is already known and in the public eye, what kind of... how much deeper do you need to go, and where do you look for those sorts of sources?
Yeah, that was a problem, because obviously this is a guy who... you know, if you're writing a book about Sajid Javid, there's a lot to be written about Sajid, right? Because not many people have done it. Gove has lived effectively in the public eye since the 90s. You know, he was a... you know, Aberdeen Press and Journal initially, then he went to the BBC, says footage of him from a BBC politics show got on the record back from 92. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that he's done you can rely on. So what I was very, very keen on doing with this book was trying to really pull out the themes and pull out a story of what this guy had gone through, where he'd come from. How did this guy who was, you know, born into care take this country out of the EU, effectively, one day, you know, lead the Brexit referendum? How did he become friends with these people like David Cameron? I think that's a really interesting story and one that hadn't been told about anyone in the Notting Hill set. So, there's not a lot of, you know, obviously the big story in there is the cocaine stuff, right? There's not a lot of sex and rock and roll in there. You know, there was lots of speculation about his behaviour at uni. I didn't really get into that because I thought it's not really appropriate. I wanted to really focus on his personality and what motivates him and the journey that he'd been on, and that's what I tried to do with the book.
Yeah, you talked about uni there. I mean, it's a strange thing in the sense that Gove seems to have had a bit of a plan from a very early age. He was a teenager, like Cameron, Osborne, Hunt, and obviously Boris Johnson, but also definitely a sense that he's not one of them. Is that a fair estimation?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think, you know, if you look at those people, they all sort of got involved. I mean, the way that Gove was at uni, he was very, very Oxford Union. His focus was becoming president of the Oxford Union. But he didn't do it on a party political ticket. When he was younger, when he was 15, he was a member of the Labour Party. He was a Corbynista, right, when he was a kid. He was a Corbynista. And then it all changed. The Falklands War had a big impact on him because he saw the strong leadership. And he went to uni and he sort of became a Tory. But even so, he was just more about debating. He was more about taking any side of the debate and arguing with it. How far can you go with your rhetoric? He was a performer, right? He was a performer. He loved performing Oxford Union. He had this skit where he'd turn up looking scruffy and say that Pepe's Filipino manservant was off for the day, and that's why, as you can say, scruffy. You know, he saw it as a sort of stand-up comedy kind of thing. Johnson, you know well, of course, being a stand-up comedian yourself. I don't know if the listeners are aware of that. But yeah, so he was very much, you know, he saw it in that kind of thing. I don't think there was with Gove I don't think Gove ever thought, right, start from down the street and work backwards. What's the 10 steps I need to do? Unlike Boris, right? There wasn't I want to be Prime Minister by the time I'm 50. How do I need to get there?
Heseltine famously had his list, didn't he?
Right, yes.
Become a millionaire, become Prime Minister.
Exactly, right. Yeah. So I don't think Gove ever really had that.
No, that's interesting. So at what point do you think 2001 was the point he thought, right, I'm going to be an MP now, or was it a bit before that?
So I think he was slightly thinking around before that, but I think what happens in 2001 is Cameron and Osborne get elected, Boris Johnson gets elected. Not only is Boris Johnson elected, he's still editor of The Spectator magazine, right? So Boris Johnson's got this fantastic career going. Gove is a leader writer on The Times. He had a not particularly successful period as Home Affairs editor, Home News editor. It's not done particularly well. It sort of becomes obvious around that time, 2001, 2002, that he's not going to be the next editor of The Times. That's given to someone else. So his career, slightly, having been on quite an upward trajectory for a long time, starts plateauing. And at that point, he's getting a lot of pressure from Cameron and Osborne, particularly when IDS is ousted in 2003, to get on the pitch. Cameron writes a piece for Guardian Online saying, it's time for you to put your expenses account to one side, get on the pitch, and, you know, actually start getting involved with Michael. And that is really what eggs him on. He sees his friends going and doing this, and he thinks, I want a bit of that as well.
I mean, as we said before, like a lot of him, he's lived in the public eye for so long. I mean, what, if any, differences do you think there are between him as a private person and a public person? I mean, is it easy to tease those out without hanging around with him, basically, for a long time?
So, my mother is a primary school teacher who hates Michael Gove, right? And you say the name Michael Gove around any teachers, and you know, you'll get the same response, pretty much. Slightly unfairly, in my view. A lot of people think of Michael Gove, and this was put to him in a hustings, as a specky git. When I speak to people who know Michael, people who like him, people who don't like him, people who agree with him, people who don't agree with him, they all say, very funny, very charming, extraordinarily polite. He's the kind of guy that if he hears your child is ill, will text you a couple of days later asking how your child was. He's extraordinarily thoughtful. I wanted to call the book, actually, This Charming Man. originally, but the publisher said, well, no one outside of Westminster will get that, which is a good point. Then no one outside of Westminster is probably going to read the book. But he is incredibly charming with people. Yeah. That doesn't come across to the wider public. The wider public do not see that.
It's a bit like Ed Balls, isn't it?
Yeah.
Totally misperceived, I think.
And they say, with Ed Miliband as well. Ed Miliband, yeah, you know, was perceived as this really geeky guy, and he's a geek, leading up to the 2015 general election. But when you met him in real life, he's got a real presence. He's charismatic. He's good looking. He's, you know, he's so different to what the camera showed of him. And Gove does suffer from that as well.
Yeah, I think another one that reminds me of is Gordon Brown, who everyone I've known who's met him said he was electric in a room.
Yeah, right.
But comes across as the most dour man. Yeah. I mean, do you think that's just sort of fear or caution or the nature of modern politics?
I think it's a little bit with how he looks. You know, he looks a bit like a nerd.
Yeah.
You know, as he'll admit. I think that actually there was a... I think he was kind of slightly happy to play that role a little bit in public, you know. And I think the big thing was that, you know, in 2014, when he was sacked by Cameron from Education Secretary, that was a big moment because if Cameron had stuck in behind him and said, do you know what? No, I wanted Michael to go and do his education reforms. I backed him this far. Okay, they might be getting people saying he's a bit toxic, but I'm going to back him. I don't know whether that would change perceptions, but because he was kind of cut adrift, there was a sense that he'd kind of got too big for his boots. There was all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one. I suppose Cameron could claim vindication because they won the election.
Yes.
And otherwise, you know, everything they've done, you know, after 2014 can be seen in that context. I mean, how much do you think that hurt him? I mean, is he someone who... People say about Boris Johnson that one of his qualities is he doesn't bear grudges. Do you think Gove is someone who does?
I don't think Gove bears grudges, but I think that the point I make in the book is that, you know, it's Cameron and Osborne are not just born with silver spoons in their mouth. They're born with a social safety net. So Cameron and Osborne can leave the top jobs in government and they're still going to be invited to the same parties, hang around with the same people, right? Gove is in this social world that he's in, which he loves, with the likes of Cameron and Osborne, because he's fought his way in there. Now, if Gove is sacked from the cabinet and cast back benches, those phone calls, they start drying up, right? His invitations start drying up. He hasn't got that social safety net. He's just a boy from Aberdeen. And I do feel like there is a class thing there. You know, Cameron was so disappointed in Gove not backing him in the referendum and then going on to be one of the front men of the Vote Leave campaign. He was so disappointed. And I do think there's a class thing. I do think there is a hint from Cameron of, you were working as a waitress in a cocktail bar when I first met you, which isn't true. Gove was successful in his own right, but I think Cameron feels that he dragged him up a little bit.
It's interesting, though, because Gove could probably hit back and say, well, I didn't want to have a referendum in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, famously, him and George are the ones who said, don't. I mean, Gove said, do not have this referendum. You know, it is not worth it. I'll have to be on a different side of the argument to you, which I don't want to be. It's going to concede things. Gove could see this coming. Now, the thing with Gove is anyone who knows Michael Gove, the idea that Gove was going to back Leave but be very quiet about it and maybe write a few op-eds, I mean, it's just nonsense. Gove's never done that. Gove's never, ever ducked a fight. Gove, this is a guy who got in an argument with a World War I professor about the merits of Blackadder, right? An education secretary. This is a guy who loves an argument. He will build a road to cross it to start a fight. So the idea that Gove was going to sit out the 2016 referendum out of loyalty to Cameron, when Cameron had not shown him loyalty 2 years before, of course, was just naive on Cameron's part. And I think that, you know, Gove was always going to play a leading role in that campaign.
Yeah, I mean, what do you see, without gazing into your crystal ball, what do you see as next for him? Do you think he would stay around if there was a general election and the Tories lost their majority? Could you see him hanging around on the back benches? Or now he's had years and years of being in big jobs, would that seem like such a relegation that he wouldn't bother?
I think if the Tories are in opposition, I think Gove would actually appreciate the intellectual challenge of how to reinvigorate the party. And that's why he's done lots of stuff last summer. He did lots of stuff, you know, with you guys and other think tanks about, you know, how do you reinvigorate the party? How do you make capitalism work for a new generation? Trying to bring on new thinkers. So I think Gove would actually appreciate, would take to that intellectual challenge quite well and quite quickly and with enthusiasm. I think he'd like to see himself as someone who helped to rebuild the party. I think there's a situation where Boris could be Prime Minister for a very short period of time. There's an early general election. who knows if he stays party leader after that? Who knows if Gove has another crack at it? People might all come around and say, Michael, we need you. We just don't know.
Yeah, I think if the last 3 years have shown us anything, it's making predictions. Bit of a mug's game.
Absolutely.
I mean, apart from Michael Gove, you spent, what, 15 months researching him. I think probably the politician you know best is Nigel Farage. Is that fair?
Yeah.
I should say for listeners, Owen's first book, which I'd recommend reading, if only for the opening about Dexys Midnight Runners, is Following Farage, which you spent, I don't know, how long was it, about a year?
A couple of years, yeah. A
couple of years, just on the coattails of the then UKIP leader.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you make of his sort of transformation into a almost sort of a poster boy of the alt-right, Trump fan, ally, all this?
It's strange because, so I followed him, reporting him from sort of 2013 to 2015 to the general election. So it was just when they did win the local election results in 2013. So it's when UKIP really started taking off and everyone was like, we've got to take this guy seriously. Carswell defected, Rex defected. And at the time, they were desperately not trying to be alt-right, actually. They were desperately trying to paint themselves out as just, you know, sensible people of this country. With the exception of Raheem Kassam, who was a guy who was Gove's sort of chief advisor. And he was the
Farage's
guy. Sorry, Farage, beg your pardon.
We're Gove'd out.
Sorry, Gove'd out. Yeah. Farage's chief advisor, who worked for Breitbart, had links with America, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he thought that you should adopt this kind of Trumpian-style politics before Trump. And Farage did do a little bit of that, hence the comments about people with HIV shouldn't come over here and that kind of stuff, which actually turned a lot of people off. But then Farage fully embraced that after the 2015 election, lead up to the 2016 referendum. And if people say, well, what would Farage do outside politics? We saw it. He was on Fox News all the time. You know, the guy was talking down Britain, as far as I was concerned, a lot. And he's sort of trying to come back a bit more now into the mainstream of British politics. Trying very hard to separate himself out from Tommy Robinson, one of the precursors for him leaving UKIP. So he's sort of trying to come back into the mainstream a little bit. But the difference now is that when he was UKIP leader, you could dig up some councillor from, you know, slowly on the world and say they said this awful thing and have to defend it. Now he hasn't got to do that. Now he's just got, you know, just got MEPs to talk about. He hasn't got any of that nonsense, as he saw it, of actual party behind him.
In a way, like UKIP and Gerald Batten made it easier for him by being so extreme.
Exactly.
Well, look at me, I'm all right compared to them.
It's exactly what happened. And you know, Farage kind of got out with his nose clean on that. But I think Farage probably has to look at the way that party was so engulfed by that thought. And I think that Farage does have a responsibility for that.
I mean, I've interviewed Farage a couple of times. I wouldn't claim to know him anywhere near as well as you. But what struck me is that actually his public persona of being a sort of chummy boozer is exactly what he's actually like.
Exactly.
In private.
People will say, what's Farage really like? He is really like that. The only difference is that Farage would prefer a glass of red wine to a pint of ale. He was pictured drinking a pint of ale at one point and it did really well. So he likes ale, but he actually prefers red wine, but he kind of keeps that a bit of a secret.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really touch the sides with him either.
No, I mean, the guy can drink. The guy can... I interviewed him for Following Farage and I said to him, do you think you're an alcoholic? And he thought about it and he said, no. But I think his tolerance for alcohol is extremely high. Yeah. I mean, he can drink throughout the day and give the same speech in the evening that he gave in the morning with the same intonations and humour. It's a fantastic public speaker. I mean, and what Farage did, which I think he deserves a lot of credit for, is he went to places where politicians weren't going because they either thought they couldn't win there or they thought they were definitely going to win there so they need to go and actually warm these places up. Farage went into those places and he held meetings in rooms and halls and pubs and he walked around the streets and he spoke to people. And it was a real kick up the backside for a lot of politicians in this country.
The other thing that always struck me about him, again, both sort of on telly, but also especially in person, is how he just seemed knackered a lot of the time. And when he went off and started doing Fox News, I thought, right, he might just stick at that now. Because the life he led before was so demanding, being a one-man party, effectively. I mean, how surprised were you when he came back into frontline politics?
Not surprised at all, because he loves the adrenaline of it. He loves being front and centre. He loves causing trouble. And he really believes in Brexit, right? He really, really believes in it. He really, you know, he does believe in it. So I think he feels it's not being delivered. Now, the question is, if Brexit had been delivered March 29th, what would Farage have done then? Would he have found a new issue to line himself to, and I think he would have done. One of the things he says to me in the book is that he, in Following Farage at the end, is that he thought the next big battle would be basically the gated communities, right? A load of people that are very rich can afford to put gates up and lock the poor out, and he thought that was going to be a big thing. And it hasn't quite materialised yet, but I think he's probably kind of onto something there.
Yeah, it's quite noticing from the Brexit Party is that actually they don't mention the EU all that much for a party called the Brexit Party.
Yeah. I mean, the conclusion that I drew from speaking to a lot of UKIP voters and people who became UKIP voters during that period was what united them was not necessarily a disliking of the EU, although obviously it did. It was actually a sense of a lack of patriotism from the people who ran the country, a sense of a bit of a shame about the country, a bit of shame about the Union Jack. And if you cast your mind back to, you know, to 1997 with Tony Blair, what did Tony Blair do? He wrapped himself in the Union Jack. Cool Britannia, Union Jack flags waving when he became Prime Minister. You know, Noel Gallagher with his Union Jack attire. It was a really patriotic time. And that kind of had all, to a lot of UKIP people, had kind of all disappeared. And there was a sense we were slightly embarrassed by who we were in the world, which is why I think Corbyn doesn't do well with the working classes in this country. And you can see it from the last election results, is because there is a sense that he just is not patriotic enough.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, with Corbyn, his preoccupations are just not the same as a lot of ordinary people. Exactly. Like, they don't give a shit about Iran or Venezuela or any of that stuff.
Exactly, yeah. And their default position is to be on the side of the British, and people question whether Corbyn's default position is to be that. And you only have to look over the Skripal poisonings.
Yes, indeed. Or, I mean, any press release that Seamus Milne crafts seems to have the same formula.
Indeed.
Restraint on all sides.
Restraint on all sides, it's America's fault, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just coming back to the Brexit Party, I mean, with your sort of an analyst hat on, do you think that a Brexit of some description will kind of kill them off? Or is Farage right when he says this is just the beginning and actually this is about normal people against the elite?
I mean, Ken Clark had that great phrase, didn't he? You know, if you keep feeding the crocodiles, they'll keep coming to the end of your boat, or something on this phrase, about Eurosceptics. And I think that's right. I don't think Brexit kills them off, because if you've created a narrative, which is what the Brexiteers have successfully done, that this form of Brexit isn't true Brexit, you can keep that going forever. You know, the reason, you know, I thought it was really funny when the May's deal was put forward, people like Jacob Rees-Mogg were going on television saying, this isn't Brexit. And then polling was coming out, people saying, it's not Brexit. Going, look, people don't think it's Brexit. Yeah, because you've been telling them it's not Brexit for the past 2 weeks. Of course they're going to listen to you. And I think that is, you know, what the kind of Nigel Farage modus operandi is, just to completely, you know. And then we have Brexit, and then guess what? The trade deal with the US isn't done properly, or the trade deal with so-and-so isn't done properly, or the new immigration laws aren't done properly. So there's always going to be something. Brexit is not a one-day event.
That's the kind of beauty of the post-truth politics era, is you can just say something hasn't worked, however it goes.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's cottoned onto that in a way.
Exactly.
But do you think there's also a kind of corollary risk, though, that if we do go for no deal, things don't go so well, and they then are the ones who get the blame? Or again, is it just, no, it's the government, they didn't do it properly?
Yeah, I think it's then becomes they didn't prepare properly. Well, we would have got no deal if only we'd come out earlier or later, or it's all Philip Hammond's fault for not preparing. You know, it'll all be that. There'll always be, you know, this style of politics is always about pushing the blame onto someone else, not taking responsibility, in my opinion. And that's, you know, that's one of the sad things about someone like Farage, because I've got a lot of respect for Nigel Farage for a lot of things that he's done. But there's some things that he does, I just think, I'm not sure about it.
And just to finish off, I mean, what do you think, having been a lobby reporter for some time now, what do you think the press's responsibility is in all this to, you know, because you've always got to draw that line between something that you know is going to get tons of hits if you dress it up in a certain way, and kind of probity?
I think that the Westminster lobby in particular is one of the institutions that's not even tried to learn from Brexit, actually. I think a lot of institutions have thought we got Brexit so wrong, why, and tried to look at itself. I don't think the press has really considered that yet. But we're in a difficult situation. If a politician says something that we know to be wrong, do we have a duty to report that because our politician has said it and then add the caveat that it's wrong? Do we have the duty not to report it because it's wrong and therefore we shouldn't report wrong things? You know, I think that's a conversation that we all... I don't really know the answer to. I mean, the famous example, of course, in the UK is the big red bus in the the referendum. You know, Vote Leave themselves said they loved the fact that the 350 figure was controversial, because it meant every night Laura Kunzberg was on the news going, this figure here is controversial, and everyone's going, God, that's a lot of money going to the EU. And it just kept the story going. So what do? Do you just not cover the bus because it's like we think it's wrong? Or how do you do that? So I think the press is in a very difficult situation. But I think that, for example, things like the Boris Johnson with the kipper he held up the other day, his rally, I think people were pretty quick to point out that wasn't as he was phrasing it.
Yeah, I think, but as you say, I mean, there's a problem with it kind of, if you're on one side, it'll just feed into your preconceptions or whatever. Yeah. So you see a lot of stuff on The Guardian and The Independent about how actually the Isle of Man isn't in the EU.
Yeah.
Whereas other papers might just ignore it.
Yeah.
So selection is really as much of a thing as the angle that you choose. Yeah.
And I think actually that there is, you know, it's very easy to decry the sort of right of this country, but I think the left have got to take some responsibility as well for some of the things, some of the left-leaning media, because, you know, they're lazy. Some of the people, things people write in the left-leaning press really annoys me because it's lazy. Or you know, there's plenty of, there's, I remember this very clearly writing on, reporting on UKIP. There was plenty of things in UKIP you could legitimately criticise them for, legitimately, right? Criticising UKIP for the fact that a councillor somewhere, a parish councillor somewhere, said that the reason why we've had floods is because we legalised gay marriage and that's God's revenge, right? This guy had been a Tory council until 3 or 6 months earlier. The fact that we kept bringing that up as a press to beat Farage with, I think people see through that and go, is that it? There's loads of stuff you could have had a go at UKIP about. Why are we picking on that? It just seemed really, really odd to me. As if, we've got you because someone that you've never met has said something crazy. And I think then people look at that, and I think there is, and I don't want to get, you know, too far into a Robinson thing, but they look at things like the reporting on much more serious things in this country, like child grooming gangs, which gets nowhere near enough, or wasn't getting anywhere near enough coverage. And I think people then look at it and go, well, what's going on here?
On that extremely happy note.
I know, sorry about that. That's a bit dull, wasn't it? Do you want to go back? Do you want me to tell you some saucy stuff about Gove, or is that all right?
Yeah, go on then.
Shall I tell you the story about Gove's penis?
Yeah.
Is that too
blue for this?
That
sounds a lovely way to end things.
So Michael Gove, there was a...
Oh, I think I know about this.
There was a photograph taken to mark the millennium at the Times, taken in December 1999 in a car park outside the Times HQ. And Gove was heard to say, can you hurry up and take this picture? It's so cold, my cock has shrunk to my knee.
Goodness.
All right?
Yeah.
Bit of blue?
Yeah. It's a little bit blue. Thanks so much.
You're speechless,
for that,
aren't you? You're speechless.
That enduring image.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.